Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com.
This hour's top stories: Israeli warplanes attack the Gaza Strip, targeting several areas in the besieged Palestinian territory. The International Criminal Court adds the multiple demolitions of a Palestinian village in the Jordan Valley to its file of alleged Israeli war crimes. Also ahead, Hurricane Grace unleashes severe flooding and mudslides in Mexico, leaving at least 8 people dead. Welcome to the program. Israeli warplanes have pounded at least 3 targets in the besieged Gaza Strip. The regime claimed the airstrikes were in response to a protest marking the 52nd anniversary of the burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Our correspondent there, Ashraf Shannon, joined us earlier with an update.
Israeli fighter jets attacked at least 3 areas in the Gaza Strip. They started by attacking the new Fisherman Pier in the west of the central Gaza Strip refugee camp of Al Buraj, and also attacked an area near the Gaza Sol power generating plant, and also attacked an area in southern Gaza city itself. At least 2 of these places have the Hamas military wing, Qassam Brigade's training centers that are located close to those areas that were attacked by Israeli fighter jets. The Israeli regime claims that these attacks were retaliation for the protests that were taking place earlier today as Palestinians marked the 52nd anniversary of the torching of the Al-Aqsa Mosque in quotes by an Australian Zionist fanatic.
More than 40 Palestinians, including 22 children, are injured as Israeli forces open fire on protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The protesters called for an end to the Israeli siege of the Gaza Strip. Health officials said 2 Palestinians and an Israeli soldier were injured seriously. The demonstrators were also marking the 52nd anniversary of the burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by an extremist Australian Christian. Marking the occasion, the Office of President Mahmoud Abbas called on the international community to protect the holy sites in Al-Quds.
The National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip commemorated the 52nd anniversary of Al-Aqsa Mosque burning by holding a huge rally along the separating border East Gaza. Al-Aqsa Mosque was burned by an extremist Jew in 1969. Palestinian factions expressed their condemnation of Israel's long history of crimes against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Today marks the 52nd anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. This incident shows the true nature of this occupation. Palestinians here vow to continue their battle against this occupation across all occupied lands. We remain united in this endless battle with all possible means.
This rally comes in conjunction with the current Israeli violations in Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli regime is imposing the policy of eviction and displacement of Palestinians and keeping their killing and land-grabbing operations in an attempt to Jewidize Al-Quds and get rid of its people.
Palestinians have gathered here to assert the unity of all Palestinians in the face of occupation. Palestinians are here to say no to any Israeli attempts to Judaize the Palestinian lands. Palestinians won't accept any violation against Al-Quds, and the resistance will go on until liberation of all Palestine.
The resistance declared it won't allow Israel to violate Palestinian sanctities and keep the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, as they agreed to activate the popular resistance and the return of clashes by the separation fence, stressing they won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes.
Palestinians have proved that they will keep their resistance in the face of all Israeli projects that aim to demolish the Palestinian identity. Al-Quds is the symbol of our history. Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque are our red lines, and we won't accept any Israeli violation of our holy sites. Israeli regime must be held accountable for any action against Al-Quds.
52 years after Al-Aqsa Mosque was set ablaze, Palestinians here call for defending Al-Quds with all possible means until its complete freedom from occupation. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The International Criminal Court has added new cases of Palestinian homes demolished by Israel to its probe into the regime's war crimes. The International Tribunal said it will review the Israeli military's razing of several structures in the village of Khirbat Humsa in the occupied Jordan Valley. The cases were sent to the ICC by Israeli NGO Combatants for Peace. Former ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda opened a war crime probe into Israel's actions. From 2014 and onwards, the regime's settlement construction, razing of Palestinians' homes, and military actions in the besieged Gaza Strip are among the issues under investigation. Political commentator Professor Bruno Biclini says Israel is an apartheid regime that promotes ethnic cleansing in the region.
Rules for the international community, for the international system, that Israel, the Zionist entity, is an apartheid state. They are promoting ethnic cleansing since the late 20s. They never said nothing different from this. And we can prove, as international studies scholars, that the state of Israel is composed majority by European invaders who are still invading the Jordan Valley, Al-Quds, the West Bank, sieging Gaza, and also inside the occupied territories in 1948, they are promoting apartheid. I can barely imagine what would happen if it was promoted by the de Klerk regime, Peter Botha regime, in the old South African apartheid, because it's quite the same. We could say that without United States support, infinite support for Israel, they could never proceed during an apartheid regime like they are doing. But also, the most important thing is not to rely on ICC. It's important, but the most important thing is to rely on the Palestinian Arabic diaspora. For example, here in Brazil, we have 60 million people from Arab descendants who are still very vinculated to the Bilad Hashem and to liberating Palestine, securing Lebanon, and liberating Syria from the Salafist invaders.
Lebanon's government has decided to increase the exchange rate used as a base for fuel imports. Central Bank Governor Riyad Salama said the government will raise the exchange rate used to price fuel to 8,000 pounds per dollar from the previous level of 3,900 pounds to the dollar. The government says the decision is to ease the country's crippling fuel shortages. President Michel Aoun said the government treasury will bear the cost of the continuation of fuel subsidies. Earlier, the United Nations Children's Fund warned that millions of people in Lebanon could face a critical shortage of water soon due to the fuel crisis. Lebanon's fuel crisis worsened earlier this month when the central bank said it could no longer finance fuel imports at heavily subsidized exchange rates and would switch to market rates. Our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, says the current fuel crisis in the country is unprecedented, and the government hopes that the new measures yield result.
Basically, we reached a state where the crisis is unprecedented. It's very much dire, more than any time in the past. So therefore, the government had asked for more subsidies and more funds to be given to the shipments of fuel that are coming into Lebanon. The governor of the central bank had refused, saying that we have absolutely no more reserves. We cannot tap on the reserves in order to pay that amount. Therefore, President Michel Aoun called for an urgent meeting today. And that is where they came to a compromise, if you may say. They decided to basically liberate the price of fuel, not keeping it to the original rate price. We're talking about 3,900 lira per dollar for the barrels of fuel that are coming in. That was the price that that was a subsidized price that the central bank could not pay. So therefore, they decided to upgrade that price and make it to based on the market, but not completely the market. It is somewhat less than what we see in the black market. So this is why they decided upon 8,000 lira per dollar.
The United States and Germany have advised their nationals in Afghanistan to avoid traveling to the Kabul airport. The two countries cited security risks outside the airport gates as the reason for issuing the warning. The U.S. and European countries are trying to evacuate their citizens as well as Afghans who worked for NATO forces. The EU says it is impossible to pull out all allied Afghans by the end of August. Thousands of people have gathered outside the airport for a week trying to get a flight out. The Taliban have urged those without travel documents to go home. At least 12 people have been killed in and around the single runway airfield since Sunday. The Taliban say they plan to unveil a new model for governing Afghanistan within the next few weeks. They also emphasize the importance of holding a wide range of consultations with other political leaders. The move has been welcomed by political circles in Afghanistan. Amin Alami is in Kabul.
Taliban leaders are busy in these days as they are facing the challenge of good governance in Afghanistan. To this end, they have decided to pick up some key steps to prove their capabilities by unveiling a new framework for governance within next days. The Taliban say they aim to keep up consultations with former high-ranking officials, prominent political leaders, and the rest of political activists in order to establish an inclusive government.
We want to establish a government in which all sides, including political groups, ethnic groups, and religious groups, have their share in. We are trying to reach an agreement with other sides in this regard. We are not after war. We are seeking peace and calm for our country.
In the meantime, top Afghan political leaders urged the Taliban to continue its efforts to attract more local and international support. This will not happen, they warned, unless the Taliban listen to the voice of people.
I do not expect the peace plan developed entirely by the U.S. to be fruitful. Therefore, regional countries need to take the initiative and work together on the issue, or at least put pressure on the U.S. to work honestly.
Taliban war comes as thousands of Afghans seek to get out of their country via Kabul International Airport since Taliban took control over the city almost a week ago. The rising number of horrified people in and around the airport has created a big chaos there, resulting to the death of 12 so far. Two of the victims, including a member of Afghanistan's national football team, lost their lives after they fell from this flying U.S. military aircraft. The incident shocked the entire world. Taliban say they plan to investigate reported cases of atrocities by the members against civilians, including journalists. Taliban are going to set up separate teams for dealing with Afghanistan's internal security and financial crisis as well. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Thousands have taken to the streets in central London to protest the takeover of Afghanistan by Taliban militants. Several thousand people marched toward the residence and office of Prime Minister Boris Johnson in the capital. The protesters also voiced solidarity with Afghans opposed to the militants' control over the country. The UK premier has come under sharp criticism over his government's handling of the crisis in Afghanistan. Thousands of Afghans have been trying to flee Kabul since the Taliban took control of the city on August the 14th. To our third headline story, and Hurricane Grace has pummeled Mexico with torrential rain, causing severe flooding and mudslides that killed at least 8 people. The government said 6 of the casualties belonged to a single family. Grace was whipping up maximum sustained winds of over 200 kilometers per hour when it hit the resort of Tecolutla in Veracruz State in the early morning.
Earlier in the week, Grace pounded Mexico's Caribbean coast, downing trees and leaving nearly 700,000 people without electricity. It, however, did not cause any loss of life. A recent UN report says nearly 21 million Yemenis are in a dire humanitarian situation and that their condition is getting worse day by day.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is worsening amid the ongoing Saudi war and siege. A recent report by the United Nations Population Fund suggests that 20.7 million Yemenis require humanitarian assistance, while over a million pregnant and breastfeeding women are projected to suffer from acute malnutrition throughout 2021. The COVID-19 pandemic, along with the torrential rain and the currency collapse, has also contributed to the deterioration of the already catastrophic humanitarian situation in Yemen, the report said. For instance, by the end of June 2021, nearly 7,000 cases of COVID-19 and more than 1,300 associated deaths had been reported amid concerns that the real number of infections were being underreported.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen has become very difficult, especially since the United Nations and donor countries have not fulfilled their pledges toward Yemenis. There is also COVID-19, which continues to spread and kill more Yemenis, amid the absence of the Ministry of Health, and there are no statistics on the epidemic in Yemen. Yemen is going through the worst humanitarian crisis in the world, according to the United Nations, amid international silence.
Earlier, the United Nations reported that it had only received half of what was required for the humanitarian response plan of 2021, which was estimated at $3.85 million, despite donors stepping up their support compared to 2020.
Observers say Yemen will continue to face a devastating humanitarian situation that risks turning into famine if the international community does not act urgently. They say the only solution is to pressure Saudi Arabia to lift the siege imposed on millions of Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
If the United States is ultimately allowed to extradite Assange and try him under the Espionage Act, it will send an ominous message to investigative journalists that they publish material critical of the U.S. government at their peril. This would threaten freedom of the press under the First Amendment and deprive the American people of crucial information with which to hold the government accountable. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Marjorie Kahn, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Threat of Extradition for Assange Grows Following. British High Court ruling. Stay tuned for more. On August 11th, in a rare occurrence, the UK High Court's Lord Justice Timothy Holyrood and Justice Dame Judith Farvey overruled the July 5th decision of Justice Jonathan Swift and allowed the Biden administration to add two additional grounds for its appeal against Julian Assange, who is being held on charges filed by the Trump administration under the Espionage Act. Assange was indicted for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Guantanamo that Chelsea Manning furnished him and WikiLeaks. He faces 175 years in prison if he is extradited from the U.K., tried and convicted in the U.S. Just Swift had ruled that. The United States could base its appeals on three of the five grounds it requested. The August 11th ruling allows the U.S. to argue two additional grounds as well. The expansion of the U.S. appeal is a worrying sign for Assange and for the future of investigative journalism. In September 2020, a three-week extradition hearing was held in Assange's case. On January 4th, UK District Court Judge Vanessa Beritzer issued her decision denying the Trump administration's request to extradite Assange to the U.S. to stand trial. Judge Beritzer ruled that Assange would be a high risk for suicide in light of his mental state and conditions under which he would be held in U.S. prisons. As Donald Trump was leaving office, his administration successfully petitioned the High Court for permission to appeal Judge Beritzer's ruling. Joe Biden should have dismissed Trump's appeal, consistent with the Obama-Biden administration refusal to indict Assange out of fear that indicting a journalist would imperil the First Amendment's guarantee of freedom of the press. No journalist or media outlet has been prosecuted under the Espionage Act for publishing truthful information. The First Amendment protects journalists who publish illegally obtained material that is a matter of public concern, including evidence of war crimes. The U.S. government has never prosecuted a journalist or media outlet for publishing classified information, which constitutes an essential tool of journalism. But Biden is doubling down and continuing Trump's appeal. When the United States appeal is heard on October 27th and 28th, the High Court may reweigh factual findings made by the district court judge, who was uniquely positioned to determine the credibility of the witness who testified at the extradition hearing. The five grounds on which the Biden administration is appealing the denial of extradition are as follows. Judge Beritzer committed legal error when she concluded that extradition would be unjust or oppressive due to Assange's mental or physical condition under Section 91 of the 2003 Extradition Act. Judge Beritzer should have notified the U.S. in order to provide it an opportunity to offer assurances to the court that Assange would not be subjected to conditions that imperiled his health and his life. Judge Beritzer should have excluded or assigned less weight to the evidence of defense psychiatric expert Professor Michael Koppelman regarding the severity of Assange's mental condition. Judge Beritzer committed error in her overall assessment of the evidence of suicide risk. On July 5th, the High Court allowed the U.S. to appeal on all but grounds 3 and 4. After the August 11th ruling, the U.S. is now permitted to appeal on all five grounds. Judge Beritzer relied largely, but not exclusively, on the evidence presented by psychiatric expert Michael Koppelman. In her January 4th ruling, Judge Beritzer wrote, Koppelman assessed Mr. Assange during the period May to December 2019 and was best placed to consider at first hand his symptoms. He has taken great care to provide an informed account of Mr. Assange's background and psychiatric history. He has given close attention to the prison medical notes and provided a detailed summary annexed to his December report. He is an experienced clinician and he was well aware of the possibility of exaggeration and malingering. I had no reason to doubt his clinical option. Koppelman, an international authority on neuropsychiatry, evaluated Assange in prison and concluded that he was at severe risk of suicide if imprisoned in the U.S. Judge Barrister cited Koppelman's statement, "I am as confident as a psychiatrist ever can be that if extradition to the U.S. were to become imminent, Ms. Assange will find a way of suiciding." She noted that other experts corroborated Koppelman's predictions of suicide. The United States is arguing on appeal that Judge Barrister should have excluded Koppelman's evidence or given it less weight because he omitted from his December 2019 report that Assange had a partner, Stella Morris, and they had two young children together. Koppelman knew about them but was concerned about Morris' anxiety about the privacy of her children. Both Koppelman's subsequent report in August 2020 and his testimony at the September 2020 extradition hearing referred to Morris and their children. By then, it had become public knowledge. Judge Barrister considered Koppelman's two reports as well as his testimony before rendering her January 4th ruling. She acknowledged the initial concealment but excused it. Writing, "I did not accept that Professor Koppelman failed in his duty to the court when I did not disclose Ms. Morris' relationship with Assange. In my judgment, Professor Koppelman's decision to conceal their relationship was misleading and inappropriate in the context of his obligations to the court. But an understandable human response to Ms. Morris' predicament, in short, I found Professor Koppelman's opinion to be impartial and dispassionate." The United States is presenting assurances that if Assange is extradited to the U.S., tried, convicted, and imprisoned, he will not be subject to special administrative measures, which are onerous conditions that would keep him in virtual isolation or be held at the ADX Maximum Security Prison in Florence, Colorado. These so-called assurances are conditional, however. The U.S. reserves the right to impose SAMs or hold Assange at ADX if future behavior warrants it. And the U.S. cannot guarantee that Australia would consent to host Assange incarceration. The U.S. is arguing that Judge Barrister should have told them during the extradition hearing that she intended to refuse extradition based on Assange's life and health if imprisoned in the U.S. They would then have presented assurances at that time, but their current proffer amounts to new evidence that should have been submitted at the extradition hearing. In October, the High Court, during the appeal hearing, will consider the grounds that the U.S. is raising on appeal and determine whether to sustain or overrule Judge Barrister's decision denying extradition. If the High Court affirms the District Court ruling, the United States could ask the UK Supreme Court to review the case. If the High Court overrules the District Court decision, Assange could appeal to the Supreme Court and then to the European Court of Human Rights if the Supreme Court ruling goes against him. If the United States is ultimately allowed to extradite Assange and try him under the Espionage Act, it will send an ominous message to investigative journalists that they publish material critical of the U.S. government at their peril. This would threaten freedom of the press under the First Amendment and deprive the American people of crucial information with which to hold their government accountable.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear listeners, and since today is the 12th of Muharram, which according to a narration is the martyrdom anniversary of the survivor of the tragedy of Karbala, Imam Zainul Abidin, peace be upon him, let us listen to one of his wise statements. Do not precede the acts of obedience to the tyrannical rulers and the pleasures of this world to the fulfillment of God's instructions and the acts of obedience to Him and to them whose obedience is incumbent upon you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience. And welcome to a new program called The Man Who Changed the World. This program is going to speak about the life and times of Imam Khomeini. And we are going to delve into the biography of this great divine personality who certainly shaped the future for tomorrow. And we are going to speak about in depth various dimensions and aspects of this great personality, and of course the impact that he made around the globe in terms of the Islamic Revolution of 1979 here in Iran. I myself am the host of the program. My name is Ijaz Husseini, and I'm going to have an expert in the studio who is going to help me through this discussion about this great personality, and that's Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who is an Islamic scholar and researcher. Salam, Sayyid, and thank you very much for being on the program and giving your valuable time to us. Thanks.
Alaykum Salaam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Great, great. So, as they say, let's begin at the beginning, and we begin with the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala on this great personality of Imam Khomeini. And we wish to, first of all, I think, as we say, begin with his birth and his lineage, his family background, of course, in Khomein, which is a small town here in central Iran, and not very far from the holy city of Qum. I think it's only a few hours' drive. And we want to, first of all, begin with the significance of the birthday of the of this Imam, and speak a bit about his family background and what were the ingredients in which this great personality was being shaped, which then of course inspired the rest of us, both in the East and the West, as Muslims. So, Sayyid Taqi, can you give us a bit of a background on the lineage of Imam Khomeini, the family background, and of course, the very humble beginnings of this great personality in 1902, which is just at the beginning of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But of course, there's a big history involved here as well in Iran, in terms of the fact that, you know, oil was being discovered, and that became a curse as well as a blessing for Iran. But at the same time, of course, there was the world powers at that time. The British were dominant throughout the world. So there's a very complicated background to all this, but it helps us to try to put things into perspective. So let us start with the humble beginnings of this Imam. May God bless his great soul.
Inshallah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, we know his name was Ruhullah Musvi Khomeini.
Yes.
And that in itself is interesting name-giving as far as his father, Sayyid Mustafa, was concerned.
Yes.
Calling him the spirit of God, Ruhullah.
Ruhullah, yes.
You know, that is an interesting grace in itself. That
it's a connotation which was used with Prophet Jesus because it really had a big impact in the West in that terms.
But then you look at how you know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, you could almost say, enlightened his father to select this name as a name for his newborn child.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, being born on a very auspicious day as well, the Wiladat of Hazrat Fatima Zahra Salam Alayha.
That's right, the birthday of this great holy daughter of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him.
He was born on the 20th of Jamad al-Thani, 1320.
Yes, 1320,
Hijri. Which is the same as, which correlates to the 24th of September, 1902. And what's really interesting, when we look at a brief background to him first, before we move into a little bit of his life history, which we come across when we, of course, when we learn more and more about this learned person, it's always important, you know. It's funny, a lot of our youth in the world know when Michael Jackson was born, where he lived, and but we don't really know the...
That is what we call the superfluous and useless information that people
Our youth are not encouraged to us learning more about their learned personalities, and therefore it's paramount.
But in a sense, Sayyidina, Imam Khomeini was no less an icon. I mean, the images...
Indeed, but then, you know, the iconic image of Imam Khomeini obviously has its, its depth in closeness to God, not closeness to Shaitan.
Right.
So we see, of course, the iconicness is in the lineage to start with. The very fact that his family is an offspring of Bibi Fatima Zahra Salamul Alayha, her great 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 grandson Hazrat Musi Kazim, Imam Musi Kazim alayhi salam.
And of course, he is of course the natural descendant of Imam Al Hussein.
Indeed.
And the thing is that I don't want to jump the gun here, but you know, you can't help when you read about this great personality that how many parallels you draw with Imam Hussein alayhi salam.
Indeed.
And this is something, inshallah, we'll speak about in a later program, but at this moment in time, we'll stick to the
lineage. What's really amazing is that when we go back to his great-great-grandparents, kind of back a little bit, we find that his parents were, his generations back, originated from Nishapur, and they migrated to Hindustan. Stayed there. And
that's right. His great-grandfather was in India, wasn't he?
Indeed.
If you recall his name for us.
Sayyid Ahmad Musavi Al-Hindi, he was known as.
Al-Hindi, yes.
What happened was that when they moved, when he moved from in the early 19th century,
interesting,
very early 19th century, they went and settled in Lucknow. In the
great Shia center of India.
And not only just the Shia center. At that time, the one of the sole Shia, you could say, the kingdoms, the Ohda kingdom.
That's correct,
of the followers of the 12 imams.
Correct, sir.
12 imams. In fact, they were the first of the Shia kingdoms in
India.
Hindustan.
That's right.
In India, lining up with the Safavis, probably the Safavis at the latter time.
That's right, because they were always in conflict with the Mughals of India.
So they went and settled in an area called Kintur.
Kintur,
K-I-N-T-O-O-R. Just outside Lucknow, it was.
Right.
And as it happens, that because his grandfather of the past, of Imam Khomeini, was himself a learned personality,
of
course. And when he settled in Lucknow, he was counted amongst the scholars of the of
the
that time.
The top-notch scholars of
high,
Lucknow.
High-ranking scholars.
High-ranking scholars.
And you must appreciate, of course, at that time, being a Shia kingdom, Farsi being a very important language within the Muslim kingdoms at that time.
Well, that's very interesting, isn't it? Because at that time, we are talking about before the British...
In fact, you're talking about the 1830s.
Right, okay. In that but even period. Then, Farsi was still pretty much in use because English was still hadn't taken hold by the Imperial British at that time.
Indeed, it was still in the scholar's circle.
It was still being used,
and,
yes.
And particularly when it came to people's want to know about Islam, they still approached people who were embedded with Arabic and Farsi as their natural contact to Islam. You know,
say that it's very interesting what you're saying, because of course the scholars who come from Lucknow speak Urdu in a totally different way. They have a completely different style, and it's more Farsi orientated than it is in normal people who speak the language, because of course Urdu meant army of words, which was a mixture of Turkish and Farsi, and of course then the British put their input into it. But of course their style of speaking is entirely different, so that's
indeed,
interesting.
Because the linguistics of Lucknow, or the spoken Urdu of Lucknow, is much more sophisticated
it
from
is.
What I understand.
It is, yes.
But then you see, it's again the dominance of the ulemaiyat in it, the scholaristic scholastic links to...
Yes,
to,
it's that
to
rich legacy in
indeed,
there.
That has remained. And in fact, even after... in Hindustan being taken over by the Hindus and
the British,
the international. No, I'm talking about 1947 and the national language becoming
Hindi.
Urdu with the sophistication has still lingered on in Lucknow.
Yeah, yeah.
But at that time, coming back to the time of Sayyid Ahmed Musawi Hindi, he as I said counted amongst the scholars of that time within the Indian scholars who were there, because of course. India has always had a very good link with Islamic environments of Najaf and Karbala of long time.
Absolutely,
and
there's a rich tradition in
indeed.
There.
And
yes.
And in the early times when the British did take over England, they understood the roles of the Hausa in India because they had contacts with Najaf and Karbala.
That's right.
And Hausas in Lucknow were held in very high regards by the Hausa of Najaf and Karbala.
Of course, I mean, this was the elite. This was the most esteemed institutions for the training of Shia clergy, and in terms of the dissemination of the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Indeed, and Lucknow played a very major role in this particular. The kingdom of Ohd played a very important role in promoting Shia, Oudh, in northern India. Mm-hmm. It had a great role to play. But what happened as we come closer to the time of Imam Khomeini's time is that when British was being... again, you could see the element of what you're trying to put in regarding Imam Hussein fighting the Zalim oppressor
right.
and everything. Mm. We find in the history of Sayyid Ahmed is that he has to move away from Lucknow, leaving his family or his forefathers, because he couldn't stand taking the influence of the British in India.
That's true.
You see, he
that's
moved
true. Because, of course, this is a very dark chapter in the history of India, because
but not only in the history of India,
but
it's in the history of the East Indian Company. A very dark chapter.
Very nice.
You know, for example, I mean, this is a point we've raised before in some other program. Mm-hmm. East Indian Company had was an extremely oppressive entity in.
We're talking about the famous Jihad of 1857 now, the Indian Mutiny.
The Indian Mutiny in itself, but the consequences of those Indian Mutiny were the facts that the British were being so oppressive to promote their capitalist doctrine that oppression was a kind of a natural progression of capitalism. You know, I'm sure you might have heard about the atrocities they committed on the weavers of India.
Of course. The big gun.
Not only the use of the big gun, the use of the small knife even.
Yeah.
Because what happened is that the British, they were taking raw cotton from India and taking it to Manchester.
That's
and
right.
Building the capital system of
and
Britain.
And undercutting the domestic market.
Undercutting on itself. What you're cutting into the conversation is this, that not only were they bringing in cotton from England in the form of shirts and things to sell to the raw market where they were getting the cotton, but they were finding out that their cotton could not compete with the local made cotton. Yes. Because the local made cotton was so more finer.
Hmm.
So on the investigation, they found out that there were female young girl weavers throughout India who were weaving cotton, which was much, much, much more softer and
better quality than
indeed,
what was coming out.
Indeed, because that was really coarse.
Sure.
So you know what the East Indian Company did? It went and arrested all these girls, and they only released them with a guarantee that they will not produce cotton again.
Mm-hmm.
And to make sure they will not produce cotton again, mm-hmm. they cut off the girls' fingers.
Oh, my God. That is barbaric.
So that is capitalism.
That is barbaric.
That is the barbaric, oppressive
nature.
Observation
mm.
Imam Khomeini's great-great-grandfather was seeing
oh
when the
goodness.
British were taking over. So he wanted
horrendous.
To part from that environment.
Mm.
And in the history of Imam Khomeini's grandfather, in fact,
mm.
because Sayyid Ahmed later on becomes Imam Khomeini's grandfather, he moves away from Lucknow.
Mm.
On the way wanting to come to Najaf and Karbala,
mm.
He relocates himself in the Kashmiri Valley. And from Kashmir, he makes his
right.
way towards towards Najaf and Karbala.
Interesting. Very interesting.
And it's really interesting that in Najaf,
mm-hmm.
Whilst he's there in Najaf and continues some element of his studies,
mm-hmm.
he comes across a person who was known as a very big businessman type of orientated individual of Khomein.
Right.
And he was quite interested in bringing an Alim ad-Din to Khomein to settle.
Right.
And so happened, as God may have wished it to be,
mm.
or God would have wished it to be, that he directed this gentleman called Yusuf Khan.
Yusuf Khan.
Yes,
right.
He's not. He was a very important person, a prominent citizen of Khomein.
Right.
He got associated with Imam Khomeini, Imam Khomeini's grandfather,
right.
Sayyid Ahmed, and invited him
mm-hmm.
to come and settle in Khomein.
Interesting. Very
and
interesting.
In settling in Khomein, Yusuf Khan then gave Sayyid Ahmed Khomeini his daughter. In marriage,
right,
and thereupon that relationship with Khomein becomes a lot more molded
mm-hmm.
for the Imam Khomeini's family,
right.
In the sense that that circle from Nishapur to
Hindustan. And this marriage of this daughter, she comes from a very religious background.
Yusuf Khan was known to be a very religious person. That's
right.
Why he had gone to Najaf to actually locate an individual to come in,
mm.
Be a resident, so as to say, resident Maulana, as we would say,
mm.
or resident Alim ad-Din,
mm-hmm.
Resident scholar of that area. So, yeah, his religiousness is quite clear,
sure.
that he wanted to have this type of rapport
mm-hmm.
with learned scholars. So Sayyid Ahmed is invited to reside in Khomein,
right.
with the fact that he's given... Yusuf Khan gives him his daughter
sure.
to make that consistency firm.
Roughly what time are we talking about in terms of the calendar?
I think, you know,
place?
Imam Khomeini was born in, we say Imam Khomeini was born in 1902. His grandfather would have migrated from India maybe in 1870, 1880. So that type of lineage of time.
Time.
That way, the chronological period that we're talking
so,
about.
You know, becoming settled in the town of Khomein. Yeah.
Because, you see, we've got a date here which talks about birth of Imam Khomeini's father
mm-hmm.
as being 1885.
1885.
Imam Khomeini's father.
Right.
Musfi al-Hindi. He was
Al-Hindi.
Known as. So in 1885, and his sister, Sahiba.
Sahiba, yes, yes.
They're two children to Sayyid Ahmed and his wife,
sure.
These two people.
Right.
And of course, both of them have very important play a very important impact, leave a very important impact in Imam Khomeini's upbringing.
Sure, absolutely. I think we'll go away for a short break at this moment, Sayyidina. You beautifully introduced the idea of the settlement of Sayyid al-Hindi, the grandfather, into the town of Khomein, getting married there. And then, inshallah, we're going to move on to Imam Khomeini's father and, you know, the role he played in Khomein. Of course, he was a great scholar, a man of great stature and esteem in the town of Khomein. But, of course, at a very volatile history of Iran, because, of course, huge changes are happening. There's the constitutional movement here in Iran, which had very negative impact on the country in terms of, you know, the imperialist hand behind it because of the British, who were, you know, making their sphere of influence in the south of the country. And, of course, you know, oil gets discovered because, of course, Iran was the first place in the world where oil was discovered. So a lot of these elements are now going to play a huge role in, you know, the coming of Imam Khomeini. But we'll go away for a short break for a couple of minutes, and then, inshallah, we'll, God willing, we'll introduce this dimension of Khomeini after the break. Please stay with us. We'll be back after a couple of minutes. Thank you. Thank you, listeners, for staying with us. You're listening to the program, The Man Who Changed the World. And, of course, this is about the life and times of Imam Khomeini. And I'm your expert host, Ijaz Husseini, on this program. And I also have the honor and pleasure of having Sayyid Taqi Razavi, who's an Islamic scholar and researcher in the city of Qum. And we got to the stage, Sayyidina, about where you were talking about the history of Imam Khomeini's grandfather, Sayyid Ahmad al-Hindi, and of course you mentioned the fact that, you know, he's left India in 1830 to go to Najaf. He meets this prominent citizen of Khomeini, Yusuf Khan, and you introduce the stage of Sayyid al-Hindi's life where he's now going to settle in Khomeini, and you certainly mentioned around 1870 that this takes place, and he gets married to a very pious lady there. And this is now the point at which we are now going to discuss, of course, Imam Khomeini's father, and in the city of Khomeini, and in the background of the volatile constitutional movement in Iran, which, you know, was the setup really up leading up to the First World War, where we get the end of the Qajar dynasty, which was very corrupt, very weak at the end, very much influenced by the imperialists, and of course the clergy. And if you could go into that aspect, you know, about the clergy taking a stand, you know, we've got the tobacco movement, you know, the great fatwa of Ayatollah al-Shirazi, you know, already showing that the, especially the Shia clergy, especially the school of Ahlul Bayt, is at the forefront of the resistance to this very dark chapter in the Muslim world. You know, as you said, as you introduced it from India with the East Indian Company. But of course, we are talking about the whole Muslim world being affected by a very dark colonial period in which we are talking about certain lights of resistance. And in that background, if you could say, then, you know, carry on with the story about what happens in Khomeini.
We came up to the point where, you know, he's invited and he's settled in Khomeini.
That's right.
And in and all the time, during his time in Khomeini,
sure,
Sayyid Ahmad had always kept a rapport. Sayyid Ahmad al-Muswi, al-Hindi, later the family becomes Khomeini.
Sure.
With his point of origin of that time, which was Hind. Largely because of the
with
fact...
India, that, of course.
With India. Mm-hmm. Largely because of the fact that, as I said, there was always a very sound interaction with the ulema circles wherever they were.
That's
because
right.
they had no concern about borders.
That's true. Like, yes,
and therefore
absolutely.
It was it didn't matter whether you were giving a fatwa or Islamic decree which related to the Chinese Muslims or the Indian Muslims or so as to say the British Muslims. It's uniform as far as its application.
I think this is also, you know, it takes us back to that wonderful hadith from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, which he says that if one part of the body is suffering of the Muslim Ummah, the pain goes to the rest of the body. And you know, in that light, the holy clergy of the school of Ahlul Bayt have always worked in this manner.
And you see,
according to this hadith.
And particularly if you look at then, you know, after Imam Khomeini's grandfather.
Sure.
The family settles in Khomeini as a part and parcel of that community without any constraints of any type. Even the friends recognized them as did the foe, or that they were part and parcel of that community and had a great impact on the ordinary people of Khomeini.
Sure.
And particularly as you pointed out, the tremendous changes that were taking place.
That's right. Yes.
And
yes.
The fact that everybody was suffering. In fact, the suffering was even right to the servants of the kings as well. You know, those who were of high regards within the king's circles were also suffering, because the king, because of his allegiances that he was creating with other people, were affecting the friends that he was creating at home and the enemies he was creating.
I mean, we're talking about a history here, not only in Iran, but also, of course, that had affected the Mughal Empire of India, the Ottoman Empire to the north of the Turks, of course. But, of course, you know, they were this was happening in stages. You know, we were seeing a terrible decline in the culture, in the power and the prestige of the Muslim world. And, of course, you know, the Europeans were making huge inroads into this part of the world. And in that background, we are seeing this, you know, especially the clergy taking up the mantle of resistance against this movement.
If we were to look at to sidetrack a little bit, we find that most of the most of the movements against the imperialistic powers throughout the Muslim communities were led by ulema.
Ulema, absolutely.
You know,
if
you even go all the way to Indonesia, where you had people, you had the movements who were revolting against the Dutch.
That's right. They were led by the expansion of the Dutch Empire in that part of the world. Yeah.
They were led by ulema, to which we find, you know, in South Africa, which was also a Dutch colony, that we have these Malaysian, Indonesian exiles who were exiled from Indonesia, settled in South Africa.
I mean, the other thing that we need to point out here, although we're not sidetracking at all, because we have to put this background into the fore, because this helps us to understand Imam Khomeini's movement, you know, at a much later stage, because it doesn't come out of the blue. It comes out of a very dark period in our history. But at the same time, we have to mention the fact that, you know, that the French Empire under Napoleon and the British, you know, were fighting over India. I mean, it wasn't like something like, you know, it was just one particular movement and then the East Indian Company happens. This all comes out of a background where the Europeans are now fighting for their own markets in this part of the world. And, you know, this barbarism, this colonialism is coming out of the fact that they're fighting and vying for their interests in this
and
part
whilst,
of
the world. And whilst going out for their interests, they didn't realize that amongst the scholars, there were people who were not going to take either side but the side of truth.
That's right.
And in
this is very interesting.
And in doing so, you find, you know, the various movements, even at a later date when you have the constitutional movement in Iran, or you have the anti-British movements in India, anti-Dutch movements in Indonesia.
And a lot of that stemmed out of Lucknow as well, because it was really the Shia ulema. But of course, we had people like Sultan Tipu, for example, although they were monarchs, we are not talking about them as Islamic movements. They were
had their support from the ulema of the of those.
That's right, to make the jihad
anti-colonial characteristics.
Yes,
and
yes.
Yeah, as it so happened, if you look at the way, for example, Atatürk worked, he destroyed the ulema strength.
That's right.
So throughout history, we see wherever the system has gone and annihilated the ulema, the movements of people have died out.
Well, and Atatürk did the thing with the Swiss code thing, that he wanted to, you know, completely manipulate the Sharia. You know, he wanted
indeed,
to remove the
but
holy
you see,
Sharia.
This is where that's why the ulema stand out.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You see, coming back to Imam Khomeini's father, we see that was born in a very difficult time, 1880s. He was born in 1885. As up to 1902, to the point of Imam Khomeini's birth, we see that he has taken on a very revolutionary position himself against the criminals of the time who were supported by the Shah of that time, you know,
that's
the Khaja,
right,
who had appointed his own stooges in the area.
Well, this is a point we have to mention, because this is a very interesting event that takes place with the town of Khomeini, because the town of Khomeini was constantly being raided by Khans and their government lackeys, because, of course, you know, the Qajar government was very weak. I mean, the central authority in Tehran had absolutely couldn't control the law and order of the country. And, you know, the British took advantage of this, because they for their own interests trying to get footholds into Iran, into certain ustans, if you like, the certain provinces of Iran, where they wanted to, especially look for oil. This was one of the main motivations for the British to be in Iran. And of course, you know, these Khans particularly were carrying out terrible crimes. Yeah. Taking away women and violating
But then you see, particularly during the time of Imam Khomeini's father, there's a lot of evilness taking place. I mean, we can discuss it further in a later program, inshallah.
I think so, inshallah, because this is a subject on its own, yes.